Hey, you're listening to the Creative Pep Talk Podcast. We help you build a thriving creative career. I'm your host, Andy J. Pizza! You can stay up to date with all things Creative Pep Talk by following me on Instagram at Andy J. Pizza. Let's get into this episode, shall we? I really needed to rehaul my website. I was talking to some web people, looking around, and I got intrigued by Squarespace's new Fluid Engine, partially because it just sounds cool, but also because it allows you to drag and resize and layer up anything you can imagine. I dove in, rebuilt my site. It's the most me site that I've ever had. I just absolutely love it. Launched it. Got such a great response. Some industry illustration and designy peers even reached out and was like, hey, who coded this thing, man? I'm like, y'all, I did it by myself. No coding with Squarespace's new Fluid Engine. I told him, like, you should go check it out. You're going to be surprised with what you can do. And I built this thing before Squarespace reached out to sponsor the show. So I was like, boom, easy peasy. I was going to tell you about this new site anyway. Go check it out, AndyJPizza.com, if you want to see what I did with it. If you want to try it yourself, make a site that's totally you, where you can build a portfolio, sell content and courses and all kinds of other stuff, head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with promo code PEPTALK, all one word, all uppercase. Your next season is looking busier than the last, take something off your plate by putting Factor Meals onto your plate. Eliminating extra decisions can free up brain power for other things like self-care and creativity, and Factor Meals makes eating well streamlined with always fresh, never frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready in just 2 minutes. They have a weekly menu of over 35 options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week like breakfast, on-the-go, lunches, snacks, and beverages. I like their little vitamin-y shots. They're tasty. I like the spicy one. Head to factormeals.com/peptalk50 and use code peptalk50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code peptalk50 at factormeals.com/peptalk50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Today on the show, Creative Worlds Collide, we have guest Austin Kleon. I feel like Austin is kind of my creative cousin who's cooler, more well-read than me, calmer. I'm like the hyper alternative of this guy. And, on that spectrum of creative to career, he's a lot more on the creative side. And he's been a big inspiration to me over the years. You know, I quote his stuff from time to time. He has his latest book is called Keep Going. And it's a great book for the times that we find ourselves in. And if you're looking for how do I keep showing up to my practice, I highly recommend this book. There's tons of good stuff in there. I just got to a part about not being obsessed with numbers as a creator, which we did an episode about that recently. And I think everybody's feeling the pain of the social media rat race, and tons of good stuff to recenter yourself as a creative in that book. This conversation was so cathartic to me. We talk a lot about just how complicated it is to be a creative fan of anybody anymore. It's a difficult thing. And how do you work through that? We talk through some really big questions. I don't know if we get answers, but I do think there's a ton of insight that Austin brings to these topics. And we also talk about how to find creative diamonds in the rough times that we're living in, dumpster diving into the cultural garbage and kind of becoming a refinery how art can be transcendent, which I was pumped that Austin was using words like that, because I feel like that's, you know, he's usually a little bit reserved in those kind of words. And I don't know. I think we bonded over the overlap in our creative philosophies, and I think you're going to get a lot from it. Here he is, creative powerhouse, Austin Kleon. You know, it's a podcaster's dream to interview someone who has some things to talk about like that.
And I don't talk to anyone anymore. I don't even get to talk to my wife anymore. We stopped walking together because the kids got too big.
Yeah.
So we barely talk anymore.
Put all of that energy in this episode, please.
Okay.
Bring it all. I want to hear all this stuff. And you're derailing my whole plan. I have a bunch of stuff I want to talk to you about. But
that's fine.
You know, you've already brought up some topics. I'm like, man, I want to hear more about this. Like the whole thing of the great artist, bad person thing. Was it you that on Twitter was talking about, I feel like it might've been you was talking about Bill Cosby, and there was something about how, yeah, dicey territory, but I feel like Bill Cosby is a great example for me of someone who I can't separate the art and the artist, because
yeah,
it was so, you know, art is so much about authenticity. And you can make authentic art about terrible, terrible feelings and it be really great art. But when you're making art and you're just what feels like a flat out lie of like, I'm a family man, or, you know, all these other things, that's when I think it becomes really difficult for me to separate it. Does that make sense? I feel like maybe you spoke on this at some point.
Absolutely. Well, I think comedians are really difficult because you have to listen to them. You know, their whole art is them. Is their voice. It's the same reason that it's incredibly hard to watch Annie Hall now.
Right.
Because yeah, you have to look at Woody Allen.
Yeah.
I mean,
true,
if Woody Allen was behind the camera, you know, like Chinatown is a little bit easier for me to process because I don't have to look at, I mean, there's that one scene with Roman Polanski, but like, I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like there's something about comedians where they're creating, even if they're creating a persona, I mean, you have to listen to their voice. And so you're aware it's them the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, I think the problem with someone like Cosby is that I feel lucky that I listened to that Cosby stuff before I knew, because now I know the connections.
Yeah.
You know, when I listen to Bill, the thing I worry about is history. Mm-hmm. And I worry about young artists not being able to trace their roots because they won't allow themselves to explore.
Yeah.
Some of these people that came before, just because they're not, we're not supposed to listen to them anymore or look at them. So, like, for example, if Chris Rock, if you're a young person, a young comedian or something, and you're listening to Chris Rock and you love him, but you don't listen to Bill Cosby,
yeah,
you don't know where that's coming from.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very, I mean, it is very, it, you know, for one thing, you could just listen to women. And a lot of this gets cleared up.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's always my advice to artists these days. Is like, you
that's
know,
amazing.
Start listening to women a lot more, and then you don't have to worry about
that's so good.
You know, because of course there are women art monsters too,
yeah,
but there are fewer of them on the whole. But you know, I think what's weird now is that our consumption has become so public. Now we're supposed to kind of like tell everyone what we're listening to and what we're reading and what we're watching. And I know that's a big part of my practice, is being open with people about my influences. But I really see a time in which some young up and coming artist is sort of binging on this forbidden fruit, you know,
yeah,
who like there's some artist somewhere, some young artist somewhere that's like, you know, you know, digesting some of this stuff and consuming it, and they're taking the good bits, you know, and they'll weave it into something new. And I mean, this is a very romantic idea, but I feel like in the future, or even in the very recent, you know, present, there are going to be people that consume things that they're not supposed to. And they're going to glean and steal things from those things, and they're going to take them, and it's going to feel totally new to people because they don't know where it comes from.
Yeah.
You know?
Definitely.
So I can see some, I could see like some young artist like totally stealing Woody Allen moves.
Yeah.
And then giving it to us in 10 years, and people are like, I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
You know, young people being like, what is this? This is cool. You know what I mean?
100%.
And in some ways, there would be a sort of Robin Hood justice to that, right?
Yes.
Because Woody Allen took so much from the people that came before him, but then he became this like sort of rotten link in the chain. And so, I don't know, maybe there's a healing element to that, that if the people who come after these quote-unquote bad men, if they can kind of take their influences and push them forward into the future, you know, maybe some of that rotten lineage gets repaired.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know for sure. But these are the ideas. This is what I think about,
man,
you know, all day.
I love that so much. And I, you know, that requires the courage to go wade into that kind of territory. And it reminds me of, you know, I'm very fascinated by this idea that the hero is only born when they have the courage to disobey their masters. Like, that's a thing I think a lot about, because like when I called myself Andy J Pizza and changed my last name, not legally, but online, that was just something that I thought my heroes would hate that. Like, they would think that was the dumbest, cheapest, you know, I just know that's just not their flavor, but it's just true to me. Like, I'm a goofball and all, you know, all that stuff. But it reminds me of something I've been thinking a lot about, which is, you know, going into my childhood and thinking, who were the biggest influences on me, and how do I want to carry the torch past what they did? One of the biggest influences on me is Ace Ventura and Jim Carrey. Like, that movie changed my life. And I thought about it, changed my life because it was a different picture of masculinity. It told me that, you know, what's all this real, how you're so weird can actually be this amazing thing. And I watch people like my dad and my mom and everyone I knew just love this person that was clearly weird. And I'd always felt super weird. And it made me feel celebrated and accepted. And yet, looking back on that movie, it's pretty, you know, transphobic as a movie. Like, it wasn't inclusionary of all kinds of people. That it maybe made me feel like accepted, but that work was not done. You know what I mean?
Right. And so what do you do with it now? You know, this is part of our work as artists, is to look back on our influences, to these things that were really formative to us, and to say, what do I do with this now? Like, what do I do with this? I mean, a really good example was Jeffrey Tambor, the actor from Arrested Development and Transparent.
Yeah,
right. I watched two of his acting workshops at South by Southwest, and they were two of the most amazing hours I'd ever seen. I mean, literally, and I've talked to other people who have seen these workshops. I mean, they were just wonderful workshops. And he said this thing that that became a mantra in our house. He said, worrying is not preparation. Worrying is not preparation. We used to say that. My wife and I used to say that to each other all the time. And we still do, actually. And when the stuff came out about him, I had this moment where I thought, well, what happens to these teachings? What happens to this wisdom that, you know, I gleaned from him? And I just decided, it's mine now.
Yeah.
It's mine. Worrying is not preparation. That's mine now. It doesn't have anything to do with him anymore, because I've taken it in, you know, I've taken it into my life. It's become something else. It's become something more, you know, meaningful to me. And so it's not his anymore. He doesn't get it. And so, you know, it's like gosh, I mean, I think especially children of the 80s, I mean, you know, just watch an Eddie Murphy stand-up routine and you're just, it's just half of it is the funniest stuff you've ever heard in your life. And the other is just, it's horrible. Yeah. You know, it's just the homophobia in that is unbelievable in something like, you know. But I think in some ways, you know, he's an example of someone who went away for a while. And I think he's sort of, I don't know that he's atoning for it, but I think we have to also, you know, who wants to get rid of Eddie Murphy in some ways? You know, I mean, I'm thinking about his recent work and how much I love it.
And who knows? He's coming back.
Yeah, Dolomite, or like he's doing Coming to America is coming back, which I just like, you know. But yeah, it's you know, but I think this is part of the work, and the work is never ending. I mean, as we evolve as a culture or devolve or whatever, you know, you've got to constantly. You know, I think for me, like a big example of this, particularly for readers and writers, is that the easiest way to understand this is to reread books. I'm someone who has preached over the past couple of years that people should reread, rewatch, re-listen to these things that had such a big impact. Because every time you come to a cultural object like that, you're literally a different person. I mean, well, I mean, maybe not literally, but in a sense, yes. I mean, your cells regenerate, you know, how many ever days, and you've had new experiences. So, you know, every time you pick up a book, you're a different person, and that makes the reading experience different. The book is the same, can be the same exact book, but you're different now, and so the reading experience is different. And that's the same for music, and that's the same for movies and whatever. And I just think... you know, it takes a lot of, you know, Fitzgerald said the sign of a true intelligence is to be able to hold two opposing, you know, ideas in your head at the same time to say to yourself, you know, this changed my life when I was a kid. And now I look at it and it's deeply, deeply flawed, you know, and to look at it and say, this did something for me then, it doesn't do it for me now. But also, well, what are the pieces, what are the diamonds I can mine out of this rough? Like, what can I, you know, what can I take out of this and you know, make it better? You know, I don't think people talk enough about how much disgust and can be a creative force. There's this great Kurt Vonnegut print what they did where he was like, you know, where did Beethoven get his ideas? You know, same as all of us, you know, it was disgust with civilization. And I love that because it, you know, I think people, you know, especially my readers, you know, when you read my books, you're really getting the most energetic, enthusiastic, helpful version of me. Like, I mean, those books start with disgust. I mean, they start with the disgust with something in the culture. And what I do is I get disgusted with something that's sort of mainstream or happening.
Yeah.
And then I think, well, what is the opposite of that? And a lot of the work is digging in the past to discover something that's the opposite of that, and then trying to put a new paint job on that and presenting the opposite in a positive manner. So, like, almost every book, you can sort of, like, I can tell you what I was upset about. And then I can show you, you know, I could, and then I can tell you how that became the book. And now this requires, I think this requires like a certain kind of heartful, misanthropic person that maybe I just am. But I don't think, I think people don't give enough credit to disgust. I mean, that's what I get out of punk rock, you know. I feel like punk rock was really about... You know, we just hated the culture and we just wanted to do something else, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that, you know, Mike Watt has always said that punk isn't a style, it's a spirit. And for me, you know, my books are pretty mainstream, but they start out with real disgust. I mean, just me being like, I hate this stuff. Yes. You know, I really hate all, you know, especially in our, you know, especially like creative advice. You know, I mean, there's stuff I see, especially now. I mean, there didn't used to be as much of it, but, you know, it's like looking at someone's Pinterest board and just being like, I want to throw up all over this. But then to take that disgust and say, okay, well, what would the opposite be? And then be generative and generous with it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. You talked about that that's kind of how the band, the punk band Wire, developed their sound. Can you speak to that?
Well, Wire, they just sort of like made a list of what they weren't going to do. So when they got together, they were just like, you know, I have to find the, I could actually find the exact list, but they just got together and they were like, no guitar solos, you know, no Americanisms, whatever that means. Yeah. I don't know what that means, but like, you know, they literally made a list of what they weren't going to do in their music. And what they came up with afterwards, you know, no solos, you know, when we're out of words, we stop, you know, we don't rock out, we keep it to the point. You know, it was just like this list of things they weren't going to do. And then their sound came out of it. And so it was almost like, you know, the things you hate become a sort of constraint creatively, where you're like, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do this. And pretty soon you've set up some rules for yourself that actually create and they're generative. You know what I mean? Like the negative, 100%.
The opposite is what you can do.
The shout nots, the 10 commandments that you give yourself, you know, they become the creative constraint that you work around. And you know, I'm a big proponent. I mean, I'm someone who believes that I just don't think artists who work without rules are I think it's very hard to make art without some rules for yourself, some sort of constraint.
Absolutely.
And if you think about punk, I mean, you know, in some ways you think, oh, the spirit is no rules. But in another sense, it's a reaction to the dominant culture too. So, yeah, I mean, I just think that that can be such a powerful force.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's almost a way of hacking what we know about ourselves, because you hear a lot right now about how you shouldn't congregate, you know, as a tribe or a political party or whatever around what you're against. You should congregate around what you're for. But it's almost like a way of using what we know that we do. We know that it is top of mind what we hate. That's just clear. But stopping there is not very creative as an act. And I think a lot about how anger is a secondary emotion. I think of it like the steam coming out of the teapot, as if there's something boiling over from inside you and it's turning into anger. Like, you should investigate that. At the bottom of that is not anger. It's not hate. It's some kind of love. It's some kind of justice. And it reminds me of Rian Johnson. I've heard that all of his movies start with something that he's angry about, and it's always something he's angry about himself.
Yes.
Like that, and he just pulls on that. He pulls on that thread.
This is exactly what I'm talking about, you know, and that is when I know that a book is here, is when I'm sufficiently angry at the culture.
Yeah.
So right now, for example, I'm very angry at dads. I'm very angry at this self, you know, I'm very angry at this kind of, you know, I, you know, be a great dad movement. Like, I'm going to teach my kids. I'm going to blah, blah, blah. Because it still is this, it's about me, you know, instead of creating, it's about what I'm going to pass on to my children. It's still patriarchal. You know, it's still like, well, this is what I'm going to be in my child's life and pass these things on. And to me, I'm like, I'm the opposite with my kids. I'm like, I'm going to create the environment for them that I always, you know, wanted, and I'm going to get out of the way. You know, I'm going to get, so like for right now, that's what I'm angry about. So the book I'm working on right now is like, how do you do that? You know, this opposite mode of, you know, not thinking about, well, what do we teach these kids? You know, instead it's like, well, how do we make spaces for kids to be more creative? And in the process, you know, make spaces for ourselves to be creative. So, you know, these are the things, but like, there's always, you know, I've talked about this before where I always have a secret sentence that I haven't come up with it yet for the next book, but like I always have something in the background that's pushing the work forward that no one will know about until after it's done. You know, so like Steal Like an Artist was really about, you know, just this cult of originality and, you know, people talking about authenticity and just this kind of, I just wanted to, you know, rage against it. You know, I didn't. And then the, you know, Show Your Work was about this kind of idea that, well, you don't show anything to anyone until it's finished. And, you know, nobody wants to see your, you know, process and stuff like that. And, you know, Keep Going was just this idea that you need to be plugged in 24/7 and that, you know, life is linear and you know, the kind of cult of productivity type stuff that I just find disgusting. Like with every book, I just have to figure out what bothers me and what I'm angry about. And then, but then turn it, you can't just, because those books are very easy to write, like where you just like, you diagnose the patient, right? There are lots of books like that. They're like, here's what's, we're sick and here's how.
Yeah.
And there's very few books that are like, here's an alternate, you know, here's a, not a cure necessarily, but here's how it could be. Here's a vision of what else we could be doing, you know? And so you have to like, I wrote about this yesterday. There's a great Bell Hooks quote where she says, you know, art isn't just about, and I'm paraphrasing, art isn't just about describing reality, it's imagining an alternate reality.
Yeah.
And, you know, people forget this. You know, they think, you know, especially our sort of like obsession with realism and authenticity and, you know, keeping it real and all that, you know, I mean, we really, that is, you know, that is sort of our but there are other modes, you know, I mean, it's interesting to read about like science fiction writers like Ursula K. Le Guin or, I was just reading about Ray Bradbury, and Ray Bradbury is an interesting writer because he really picks up, he sort of fuses realism with these other kind of art forms that weren't as, you know, science fiction, fantasy, romance, those things.
That's
that
my
people...
jam, magical realism, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
My favorite. Yeah.
But he didn't have anyone, like he wasn't in an MFA program that was like, you know, oh, well, you have to write short stories that are like realistic, you know, dark portrayals of, you know, the inner suffering of the working class or, you know, whatever it is. You know, he didn't have anyone telling him what not to read. So he just like gobbled up all this stuff. And then what came out of him was this new mix, you know?
Yeah.
And I just find that, you know, I'm always just searching for alternate models. You know, I'm searching for these people, you know, that I can, I just want to, you know, I just get so tired of everything else. Cause I think that's, you know, I think it's interesting because, you know, when people read Steal Like an Artist, they think I'm somehow against originality or against things that are new. And I'm like, you really don't know. Like, you know, they send me every mashup that has ever been done. Oh, check out this mashup and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, honestly, I hate most mashups, dude. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is, you know, metamorphosis. Like, yeah. I always loved in Back to the Future where, like, you know, Doc Brown would pull up in the DeLorean and he'd open the Mr. Fusion and he'd just throw garbage in there and then that would fuel the car. I'm like, that's really my vision of what artists have to do. They have to kind of like dumpster dive and sort through the cultural garbage and become a refinery for some of this stuff. And what comes out of you is you become the... And it can kill you. You know, I mean, like, some artists, it kills them.
Yeah.
I mean, it kills them taking in the culture that way. They become martyrs.
I was watching a video of my buddy who's a performer and a musician was showing me like his favorite performances and on YouTube. And one of them was this Elvis performance, like late in his life. And that was just, that was what I took from it, was like, this is like channeling whatever this was killed him. Like he was like shaking, couldn't make it over to the piano. Like yeah. Everyone's, he doesn't know what the hell's going on. Then he starts playing the piano and singing, and it's like God has, you know, descended into him. Like and he's like a totally different person. And you just feel like, man, was it just like so much of that translating, so much of that, I don't know, channeling of taking the shit and turning it into something different. Like, I don't know. It must wear some people down.
I think it does, but I would position at the opposite of Elvis. I would say, watch something like Amazing Grace, the Aretha Franklin documentary. Yeah. Because when you watch that, there's a different channeling going on. There's this strengthening spirituality to what she's doing. I mean, it really feels like if you don't go to church,
I mean, that's what I really believe, right? Like I believe that there's a way to do it where it actually strengthens you.
Yes.
I do believe that.
And if you want an example of how to do it, you watch Aretha Franklin, because and she's wrung out, you know. I mean, you can see her afterwards. I mean, there is a toll taken, but it's the kind of wrung out that you get after working out. Not like going on a 3-day bender, you know. Yeah. Although I think it's so fascinating because I loved it. I was watching the Keith Haring documentary the other day, and it's an American Masters on PBS.
Where's the Aretha Franklin one?
That one I think is on Hulu. I saw it in the theater a few years ago. It was just incredible. But I think it's on Hulu right now, and of course you can get it like on DVD. But the Keith Haring documentary cracked me up the other day because the one guy, one of his friends says, you know, the element that always gets underplayed in the Keith Haring story is the drugs. He was like, you cannot. He wasn't saying that the drugs were where the talent came from or anything like that, but he was like, you cannot underestimate the sheer amount of drugs this young man was ingesting and having while he was partying and on top of the world. It was so refreshing to have someone, you know, just say, well, you know, there were an incredible amount of drugs involved here. Because that just doesn't get said. You know, you watch all these documentaries and no one's ever says like, well, he was half off his gourd half the time, but we loved him.
I think that unfortunately is the case often.
Again, though, this is the thing that I want my readers, I want the culture to acknowledge, is not to wash away anyone's sins, not to forgive any bad behavior, but just to understand that we come to art to be our best selves. Like we make art in an attempt to be the best versions of ourselves, and we come to art to try to have a transcendent experience, right? Mm-hmm. We're trying to transcend everyday life. And of course there's a rough re-entry afterwards, but like it's the same for artists when they're trying to make. They are trying, you know, you got to look up the definitions of these words sometimes because they get thrown around so much. But to actually transcend, to get up out of the muck of life and to make something out of it. I know it's romantic, but it's what it's here for. You know, that's what it is. And it's the same thing, you know, I think that's one of the reasons I love the Aretha Franklin documentary is because it's set in a church. And it has the structure of a service, and it is showing what transcendence is like, both for the artist and for the audience. And it is captured on film. But I just feel like we just forget this all the time. We think that, you know, it's maddening to me, you know, this idea. Yeah. I remember vividly seeing a 60 Minutes interview or a 60 Minutes segment with Andy Rooney. You know, the old codger and him after Kurt Cobain died. And he said, no art can be as better as the person that made it. was what he said. Oh, and I thought, wow. You dumb old bastard. Like, have you not paid attention to the thousands of years of art history we have? Like, I mean, you literally have hundreds of years of history showing the exact opposite, that it's incredible that these people made these transcendent works. I mean, you got someone like Bach who, like, you know, I'll play Bach on the piano and it feels like someone scrubbed my brain with a Brillo pad. You know, I feel incredibly clean and orderly. You know, Bach was the furthest from someone who was clean and orderly. You know, he grew up in this like kind of like thuggish world. It's amazing that he wrote this music that for church too, you know. I mean, like, but that's the magic, you know, that is, we're trying to get somewhere else. If life was enough, we wouldn't make art. If life was enough, we wouldn't make art. That's why we make it. It's not enough. We want something else.
You had a quote earlier that reminded me of one of my favorite quotes. Paul Klee said that art is not to reproduce the visible, but to make visible. And I think it reminds me of what you're saying, where when you transcend in your art, and by the way, if you can't be romantic about art, I don't know what you can be romantic about. But if you transcend in art and you're showing what could be, not necessarily what you are, that is a method in which you can push the culture and humanity forward.
Yeah, there was a guy that tried to argue with me on Twitter before we got on, and he was he responded to the bell hooks quote, and he said, "Well, that's just like Brecht said, you know, art isn't a depiction of reality. It's a hammer that shapes reality." And I was like, no. That's not what bell hooks is saying. Reread it again. Bell hooks is saying, the quote is we don't just depict reality, we imagine an alternate reality. She's not talking about shaping, hammering. That's such a macho man thing to say, right? Oh, let me shape reality with my art. What a bunch of horse shit. Right. What she's saying is we're imagining an alternate universe. And if you think about it, you can portray an alternate universe that you don't have the tools to have happen in real life. I mean, the delusion that art can change life, it can, but it doesn't do it directly. I mean, it's not a hammer that shapes reality. It's you know what I mean? And I was just it's so funny, but I have a policy, I don't argue with strangers on the internet. But it's such a fundamental difference, you know. Language matters. Mm-hmm. You know, little tweaks to general ideas, they matter. You know, but to me, it was like the difference of someone like, you know, some great, you know, great man Bertolt Brecht thing versus bell hooks, which, you know, is just, it's so much of her writing is influenced by, you know, black feminism and just not having power. You know, and so to me, it's like, get it here. We're talking about, it's not about shaping reality. It's about alternate reality, you know, imagining another. Because then, even if it's not even possible right now, at least the image is there. And you can transfer the image. And the image can do something to people's minds.
Yeah, and I also, this whole discussion reminds me, I don't remember where I heard this, but I heard of a culture that their eulogies are kind of the opposite of ours, where our eulogies are almost, no matter how horrifying or horrible the person was, our eulogies are, this person changed the world and he, you know, whatever it was, it's always the greatest hits, right? And we're so appalled if we face the reality that they're complicated or whatever. This other culture, which I wish I have to find what the reference is, they go tell the whole story. They tell every single thing, bad, good, indifferent. They just tell the whole story and you ride the roller coaster. But by the end, when you know someone's story, you love them. You have empathy for them.
I think attention is love. And when you've learned someone's story, you've paid attention to them.
Yeah.
You know, in a fundamental way. I wrote my first obit this year for my Aunt Becky. And I thought a lot about how we know a person, and what we say about them later. There was sort of the official obituary that I wrote for her, where it was kind of, you know, this is what the family wanted to say. These are all the biographical details that you have to get right. I mean, there's really an art to obit writing. But then I had to write another obituary, which was one for me, which was like, here's my vision. And I suddenly, you know, kind of, I did kind of think about like the Rashomon kind of effect of how incredible it would be if you could have, you know, 20 different obituaries of a person. You know, just how magical that would be, just this kaleidoscope of what a person was like. But, you know, there were so many things I couldn't say in Aunt Becky's obituary that seemed to me so deep and so personal and would almost give you a better portrait of her than the official obit. You know, it was a very strange experience. Everyone should try to, you know... I mean, I don't wish writing an obit on anyone for a family member, but talk about coming to terms with, you know, how you know a person.
And did you say that you wrote one for yourself?
No, I've never written one for myself.
Oh, I thought you said that, and I thought, man, that's a creative prompt that could do some things. I don't know.
I think about death a lot. I read a lot of obituaries, but I don't think a lot about how I'll be remembered. I don't legacy to me. You know, people ask me every once in a while. I'm like, first of all, I'm not important enough to care about legacy. But the second thing is I have children now. And once you have kids, I mean, I think the child-free life looks wonderful, and I am totally into it. Like, I tell people, hey, man, you can live a beautiful, full, wonderful life without children. But there is something about, you know, once you do have them, you sort of like, you know, it's kind of like, well, this is kind of what I left here, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of... And I always feel like it's weird when people talk about their books as children. I'm like, so they turn on you at one point? Like, they're incredibly painful when they get there, and then the really hard work begins when they get here? Like, I don't, you know, I'm always. But yeah.
Those two things may be true about books, I think.
Yeah. I'm not saying that it wouldn't be a good exercise to write your own obit, but for me, I just think obituaries are about life. They're just about, you know, when I read obituaries, I'm always just like, how did this person do this? Like, wow. Like, I always love an obituary that has like three or four acts in it, you know, oh, and then they did this. And, you know, it's just amazing what people can deal with. Yeah.
Are you in that same kind of vein of looking back in the past? You strike me as kind of a creative historian in a way. Do you feel like that?
I love the older I get. Yeah. I really feel like people don't look back enough. I think that the deepest artists I come into contact with are usually connected to the past in some really rich and strong way. I think I've been obsessed with genealogy since I was in the third grade. I'm obsessed with family trees and lineage. But now that I'm older, I'm interested in creative lineages, the ones that you kind of make for yourself. Yeah. And that like really made its way into Steal Like an Artist, where I actually like told people, like, you know, make your own family tree.
For people that don't know that, can you just kind of extrapolate what that practice is?
Yeah. So in Steal Like an Artist, I tell people, you know, just pick your favorite artist, just, you know, or your favorite thinker or activist or whoever, and just figure out everything there is to know about that person. Just research them deeply. Just take in everything. And then find three people that influence them and do the same thing. And do that a couple times, and pretty soon you've got a history of your field that is custom made for you.
Yeah.
That is, you know, that instead of trying to gulp the whole survey of modern art, you have this very deep kind of meaningful tree that you can kind of pick from. And to me, that and if you do that with a bunch of your favorite artists, then you've got even more interesting root systems going. I'm obsessed with trees right now. I'm very interested. You know, when you were talking earlier about getting out from under the masters, you know, like changing your name to something that would horrify your favorite artists. I was thinking about something Brancusi said, which he said, you know, nothing. It was when he walked away from one of his mentors, and he said, you know, nothing grows under big trees. When young trees are growing up, they sort of are shielded by these bigger trees. Other things are happening, but they don't shoot up towards the light because there's none to get. And I always think that's really interesting. But I think about root systems a lot. I think about, like, where are you going to take from? You know, I think a lot of people misunderstand the Steal Like an Artist thing. They're like, oh, well, let me look around at what everybody else is doing, and I'll just take from that. And it's like, well, that's how to really just be derivative. The Steal Like I think actually Steal Like an Artist, I'm going to use this word. People are very turned off by it, but, like, in the true meaning of the word, I think Steal Like an Artist is a fairly conservative book in that it's interested in it's sort of interested in keeping the past around, which I think, you know, it's about being a student. You know, it's sort of this ethos of knowing what came before you and bringing those things up with you.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the deeper your connection to the past is, the more you pull that stuff into the present and the more strength it'll have to sort of be launched into the future. I mean, that's just how I kind of I think about it. But I just think that, you know, I have Fran Lebowitz on my brain because there's a new Martin Scorsese documentary about her that I want to watch. But, you know, she says she's so cranky and I love it. You know, she's always talking about how, like, you know, young people always think they just discovered bell bottoms, you know, or whatever, you know, like bell bottoms never existed before, you know, whatever. She's always talking about how, like, young people, it's like they invented things and how they don't know history, you know. But I think there's an opposite. There's the thing I'm working on vision-wise for myself is now that I'm a parent and now that I'm approaching middle age, I'm trying to work out how to, you know, the other books were sort of about being a curious young person, like looking to the past, making sure you aren't just completely in the present, but, you know, being a good student. Now I'm working on how do you continue to be a student throughout life? How do you remain what I call a curious elder?
Well, thank you. You know, I don't know if anybody can ever know if their work matters in the big sense, but your work definitely matters to me and a lot and to my listeners. And I hope that is an encouragement for you in this crazy time. So thanks.
It makes my day. And so did this conversation. So thank you.
Massive shout out to Austin Kleon for taking time to have a long chat with me. It felt so good to just wax poetic around creative practices. What an inspiring person and deeply insightful about creativity. And he always is reminding me to recenter myself in the creative side of what I do and not get so distracted by the shiny objects around career and social media and all that. All that stuff, you know, I think it's important. But I think Austin is a great continual reminder of what the most important side of our practice really is, which is the creativity. And he does such a good job of compiling the wisdom of so many creative greats. Go check out his latest book, Keep Going. It is easy to consume and deeply insightful. It's chock full of pep and insight. Thanks again. Hey, by the way, I have a new kids book out that I am freaking out about. I'm genuinely freaking out about it. It's called A Pizza with Everything on It. I am proud of this book. I know you're not supposed to say this, but I think this book is freaking awesome. The story is hilarious. It's written by Kyle Sheely and it's illustrated by me. And I'm so proud of it. I think it's a crazy kids book that is chock full with like little Easter eggs and all kinds of interesting tidbits. I cannot wait for it to drop. It's out in a few weeks. Go pre-order yours now. I would love it. It would mean the world to me if you went and got some copies and gave them to the kids in your life. They will make great gifts. Check it out, creativepeptalk.com/pizza and pre-order now. I so appreciate all of you who shared it, and we're going to keep pushing and get the word out for the next couple weeks. Parents, I'm doing a virtual drawing event with Mightier, the company that makes video games to help kids discover emotional strength. It will be hands-on. We'll be talking about how I use drawing to calm myself down, and I will be teaching them how to draw some of my invisible things. It'll be a ton of fun. We did this activity in a small group, and it was freaking awesome. It was so cool to interact with the kids. I haven't done much of that, and I cannot wait to do more, starting with this event on April 14th. The event is free, and you don't even need a Mightier account, but the spots are limited, so go register at mightier.com/pizza today. Creative Pep Talk is part of the Koloop Podcast Network. Koloop is a network of creative podcasts designed to fuel your creativity. Thanks to Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme music. Shout out to Alex Sugg for our Creative Pep Talk soundtrack. Thanks to Sophie Pizza for content assistance. Massive thanks to Jordan Aaron for editing the show so beautifully. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Until we speak again, stay pepped up.